Welcome to another episode of Sensing Spirit with Kristen and Kimmy. And tonight we have an incredibly special returning guest with us. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Cameron Pasha. He is a Hollywood writer and producer, and he's worked on multiple television series, including the Golden Globe nominated series Sleeper Cell. And in his spare time, Cameron is also a walking encyclopedia and potentially a future cult leader. And Kimmy and I will be his first members. Promise you.
I'll take that. That sounds good to me.
So everyone, the amazing Cameron Pasha, excuse me, is here with us tonight. And we just have to know, what is in your cup, Cameron?
Okay. This is chaga tea. Can you see it? Chaga is a mushroom that's actually popular in a lot of Native American, particularly Alaskan traditions, and also in Europe and in Asia. It's a worldwide mushroom. The chaga mushroom has been in many traditional cultures, been seen as it's called the same phrase it's used, interestingly, throughout the world. It's called the immortality mushroom. While it does not grant you immortality, it definitely strengthens your immune system. And they're doing a lot more research showing that the chaga tea, which is what I'm drinking here, helps suppress a lot of carcinogens and is very effective in keeping your body cancer free. And you know, we're in a crazy world right now where a lot of health craziness is happening. And so I'm very much promoting a lot of naturopathic ways to keep yourself healthy, which is ultimately the best way, in my opinion. Anything, the way God made the world has all the solutions for it. The human beings still bumble around trying to find better solutions, but all of it's been there and our ancestors knew that. So for those who have not tried chaga tea, it's really tasty, no caffeine, and very healthy for you.
That sounds wonderful. Thank you.
Immortality tea?
Well, that's what it's been called. But yeah, it doesn't mention immortality.
Well, no.
But it does.
Perfect.
It does, you know, a lot of cultures, especially, you know, you look at Eskimos and Alaskan indigenous populations who have very long lives. They don't have cancer. This is part of their diet.
I think that's perfect for today's topic.
It is. Everything's on purpose. And there's no symptoms. Yep, which is absolutely what we'll talk about, yes.
Mm-hmm. Kimmy, what have you got in yours?
Okay, this is a throwback. I am drinking out of my Sensing Spirit with Kristen and Kimmy mug. I am drinking cinnamon sugar cookie. So I was going a little crazy with the pumpkin spice because it's the season, but today I'm doing the cinnamon sugar cookie and it is delicious.
Sounds delicious. Thanks for that.
And Kristen?
I'm drinking water and I have an Elvis Presley mug. I don't know why, but I
well, because he's also immortal.
Yes.
Exactly.
In many ways, he might possibly be actually immortal, but he's certainly archetypally immortal.
That's true.
Absolutely.
That's very true. So let us know in the comments what you're drinking. And Carol says that she's so excited. She can't wait. She can't wait to enjoy Cameron and all his knowledge. And Terry says, hi, ladies. Hi, Cameron. And Joe says, hello, future cult leader.
I will take it. I will take it. You know, the cults I don't understand are like cults like Heaven's Gate. Remember those poor Heaven's Gate guys who all committed suicide?
Oh, yeah.
That's a cult I don't get, because that was a cult where the cult leader castrated himself. I don't understand that. The whole point of having a cult is having all these followers who are having sex with you. So I just don't understand why you would castrate yourself. That doesn't really make any sense to me. That sort of goes again. And then you kill yourself. You know, it's not a good cult. It's not a useful cult.
No accomplishments whatsoever. Terry says she drinks enough coffee that she should be immortal, but she's got coffee tonight too. That makes sense.
And Joe has
ruby red port. Oh. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Girl's awesome.
Homemade fruit smoothie. That sounds delicious. But all of this immortality. Red. So the whole reason this started, Cameron, was because last time you were on, you had a Vlad the Impaler mug specifically?
Yes. I have that over there, but now I just have the immortality drink.
Right. No, that's perfect. I think that's fantastic. I've never heard of that kind of tea before. So I'm definitely going to be looking that up and linking it in our comments, at least the type that it is, because I can't even remember the name of it now.
Chaga, C-H-A-G-A.
Chaga, thank you.
Okay.
C-H-A-G-A. Okay, got it. Was because you had mentioned that you spent some time in Romania.
Yeah, absolutely. In Romania, so you know, cool. I went there. I had a several week long wonderful journey throughout the country. A former girlfriend of mine was from Romania. Now she's happily married. I met her lovely husband, met her children. And so I had always wanted to go there. And I actually arranged my own Vlad the Impaler tour. I just found a really nice tour guide. And he drove me all over the southern half of the country to various places that were associated with Vlad the Impaler. And it was really a remarkable experience. And I really want to go because I didn't see the northern part of Romania where there's actually a haunted forest, which we can talk about. So that's the next thing I got to do. Yes.
That's fantastic. So what was your experience when you were there? What, as far as Vlad himself, I mean, he's touted to be the original Dracula, that's where Bram Stoker got the inspiration from. Mm-hmm. But what was your experience while you were there? What was the culture like around this individual? Because he was a king, is that correct?
Yeah, well, he was a local warlord, essentially, and he's still a national hero because, you know, his background was, this was a time when the Ottoman Empire was really expanding into Eastern Europe, and they had conquered, you know, I've just come back from Bulgaria. I was in Bulgaria just a month ago, and that was conquered by the Ottomans. That was actually physically ruled by the Ottomans, and I went to all these beautiful Ottoman, there's a beautiful Ottoman mosque from the 1500s, still in Sofia. I went there, and I went to local tourists. There's a large Muslim population that's the descendants of the Ottomans. It's the largest minority in the country. Mm-hmm. But so that was an area. I mean, the Ottomans had conquered all around Romania. They actually didn't physically conquer Romania, or at least they didn't conquer most of Romania. They had a portion of the south. But most of Romania remained unconquered because primarily of Vlad the Impaler. You know, he had actually been raised in Constantinople, which is now Istanbul, because his father had been sort of a local prince. And the Ottomans had a policy that essentially it was actually a genius colonial policy. What they would do is, in any country they wanted to control, they would essentially make the local population send their young boys back to Turkey, back to the Ottoman Empire, who would be then trained in the army and raised essentially as Ottoman soldiers, and they would be then sent back to occupy these lands. So you had a perfect system where the people would never rebel because they'd have to fight their own kids. So they never do it, right? And so this actually lasted for 600-700 years. And he and his brother Radu, Vlad and his brother Radu, were two princes that were essentially sent as children to Constantinople. His father had made a deal saying that, look, I'll send you my kids. You can raise them in the Ottoman army and whatever. Just don't invade, right? And that was the deal. And so Radu ended up going full scale. He went fully in, embraced Islam, became Muslim, became a very pro-Ottoman, nobleman. So that's the brother. And then his brother Vlad was like, no, screw all this. So his brother Vlad came back from Constantinople as a young man with a lot of hatred for the Ottoman Turks. And he dedicated his entire life to essentially fighting them. And he had, while in the Ottoman army, he had seen some pretty horrific kinds of torture and things like that were being used by the army to subjugate people. And so he said, I'm going to use these tactics and make them even worse against the Ottomans. And so he started using this horrific practice of impaling people, which is basically, you know, the enemies would have a stake run up through their bodies, right? And they would be hung up for days and dying in this horrible way like that. And that became his primary means of torture. Now, the way he used it against the Ottomans was when the Ottomans, he stopped sending, you know, his father had been sending tribute. So basically, here's money, don't invade, right? And so Vlad stopped sending that tribute because he had adopted the screw you Ottomans policy. So the Ottomans said, okay, you're not going to pay, we're going to invade. So, but when the Ottoman soldiers arrived in Romania, in the south, in the areas Vlad controlled, Wallachia and those areas, they were stunned because they found the southern villages, which is all Romanian people. These aren't Turks. These are the people of Vlad. They were his subjects. Right. He had killed all the villages and had strung up the villagers, had staked them. All these poor innocent people, thousands of them were staked. And it was just a warning sign to the Ottomans. If I can do this to my own people, imagine what I'm going to do to you, right? So he had no problem massacring his own people to achieve his objectives. I think their estimates, he may have killed hundreds of thousands of people through staking, and most of them his own, right? To stop rebellion. So, you know, so I've experienced a lot about who he was historically when I was there. What's fascinating is this guy was a really horrific guy in his own lifetime. His people feared him, right? And a lot of them were like, bring the Ottomans in. This guy's not out of his mind, right? And ultimately, you know, there's some different narratives about how he died, but the principal narrative is that he was in battle with the Ottoman Turks, And then his old soldiers said, this is our moment. And his soldiers turned and killed on him, killed Vlad, right? And basically sent his body over to the Ottomans, or sent his head. That's one of the popular stories. It's a lot, very mysterious how he died. But interesting thing is today, he is a great Romanian national hero because he kept the country from being invaded. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the way he did it, now that you have 600 years or so distance from it, you can, you don't have, you yeah. know, people at the time probably didn't like being impaled as a, you know, as a means of keeping back a foreign army. And when I went to Bucharest, which is in Bucharest, the capital, there is Vlad's, one of his he had a estate. It wasn't really a palace, but it was an estate. It was an estate in the middle mm-hmm. of the city. It's still there. You can visit it. And it's an yep. estate. And the in front of the estate was this courtyard where he would impale his enemies and then force the local people of the city and the noblemen to come have lunch and dinner with him with all these bodies all around them, right? That was his way of keeping control of the populace. So in his lifetime, Vlad had this horrific, bloody image. But what's interesting that I learned on that trip was that Vlad in his lifetime was believed by the people to be an occult figure. They believe that he was essentially a vampire. We can talk about what vampire yes. means historically in many cultures. Yes. But they believe he was what the Romanians would call a strigoi. They believe that that's not something mm-hmm. Bram Stoker invented. He found that out in his research.
Yep.
That the people of his time, the reports by German merchants in Bucharest who wrote about how the people were afraid of the strigoi king. Right, they saw Vlad as a living vampire, and they believed he was doing that. The impalements and all the horrible blood things he was doing weren't just a terror tactic; they were actually part of a dark occult ritual to make him immortal and give him power, occult power against the Ottomans. And so they believed that he was actually using blood to make himself an actual magical figure. Right? Mm-hmm. They believed that in his lifetime. And so the idea that he never died, or that when he died, he became a strigoi, a vampire, was something that was in his lifetime. People thought was going to happen to him. And the interesting thing is, so there's, again, it's not even clear where he's buried, but one of the most popular claims is this island, this small island that's just outside of Bucharest. It's like a 20-minute drive, right? It's like in the middle of a river. So I, of course, went there, and there's a monastery there that he built. And the most popular claim is that he was buried there. And there was in the underneath the altar of the monastery, there is a grave that's for 600 years has been marked with his name. So archaeologists were actually allowed to open the grave, some years ago, and they opened it and it's empty. They found animal bones in there, but they didn't find human bones. So you're left with this thing is, is it empty because that was the wrong grave? That's just a marker. Is it empty for another reason? So that's a really fascinating thing. And the last thing I'll say about that, probably not the last thing, but the one thing that what's intriguing is then Bram Stoker, it was inspired by Dracula by what he called a nightmare. He woke up in the middle of the night and there was his figure with blood red eyes standing at the foot of his bed, staring at him, right? And it was this horrific, terrifying feeling he felt, and the figure vanished. And later he became obsessed with this dream or vision that he had. And he started researching and looking into, you know, ghostly stories and horror stories and that. And then he found a painting of Vlad the Impaler with the famous big mustache, whatever. And he goes, oh, that was the guy that appeared at the foot of my bed. So we're left with wondering, was that a dream? Or is he actually a strigoi, as the people still believe? That he actually appeared in front of Stoker, maybe with the intention, let's say for a second, that he actually achieved his occult purpose and became some kind of supernatural being, a strigoi, right? That he survived physical death into this horrific new form. There are many occult traditions that suggest that these kinds of beings are fed with consciousness. If people have to be aware of them, and that gives them power, right? And so what if this being appeared before Bram Stoker in order to write the novel so that he becomes a global phenomenon and his name lives on so that that entity can still have power? That's an interesting idea.
Yes. And I was just going to ask you too, what do you think that how people put that intention into all of that, how that might play a role into Bram's experience while he was there, that, you know, people thinking about Vlad the Impaler or Dracula, that he's this demon in the night that sucks blood and kills animals. And especially since they found animal bones in what they thought was a gravesite, or his gravesite rather. What if it actually was his remains and we just find out
that they had been transfigured into an animal, because a lot of these traditions have them as shapeshifters, right?
Yes.
And so Well, certainly the archaeologists didn't go there. They assumed it's just a long grave. But it's curious that a grave inside of a monastery would have animal bones.
Yes.
Why are there animal bones? I mean, this is a grave that was drug in underneath the altar. So who's going to dig this grave under this altar and throw animal bones in there? Why would you do that?
Typically,
in and of itself is a cult. It's strange. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Typically, the bones that are remains that are buried underneath an altar at a church, they're holy. They're someone of, I guess you could say, like a saint kind of value.
Yeah. Right.
So that's what's blowing my mind right now, that there's animal bones where a saint, quote unquote, should be, or whatever title you want to give them.
Yeah. And so, that, like I said, there's things going on. You know, look, for the skeptic, the person just living in the right side of the brain, right? The left side of the brain is the rational side, and the right side,
yes, left side logical. That's how I remember it.
So but the person living in that side of the brain is only experiencing a very small portion of reality, and there's a reason that these kinds of stories exist in cultures worldwide, and they persist to this day. Is not just because people are stupid, not just because people are superstitious. It's because people experience them. People experience things, and just a few years ago, there was an incident in Romania that got national, international news, where a local village, the people in the local village were arrested because they, the men of the village, and this was talking about like 2005, right? Not long ago, the men of the village had essentially dug up a recently deceased village member, and because they thought he had been turned into a vampire, and they staked his body, cut off his head, and one of them actually ate a piece of his heart, right? As a cannibalistic thing.
I didn't hear that part.
Right? And this was discovered when the man's body, his daughter, who she had just buried him like 2 or 3 weeks before, had come to pay respects to the grave, and the grave is open, and she sees us, she's horrified. She calls the police, and they come in, they arrest the people, and eventually they give them a fine or whatever, because they're like, oh, these are just dumb villagers, right? But the fact, the reason it happened was that in that village, after this gentleman had died, suddenly people were seeing him in dreams and nightmares and becoming very sick and becoming very ill, and as if they were dying, as if their life force was being sucked out. And they kept, and again, this could be mass hysteria. And we currently, I think we're living in a planet that is filled with mass hysteria. So we can understand that happens, right? So mass hysteria does happen, but also I don't easily discount, these dumb villagers. If 7 or 8 people in a village start seeing the same guy in a dream and something's happening to them, something's happening.
Something is
so
definitely
would
happening.
Would you say that even the fact that everyone in the village were, putting that intention out there, that could have had some type of spiritual effect on,
chicken and egg, right? I mean, who knows? One person had this strange dream and then recounted to others. And then, we have this concept in mystical traditions of the tulpas, of these thought forms, which is that when multiple people, or even one person, when they're very focused spiritual power, imagine something, it takes a physical form. And this has been documented. Alexandra David Neal, who is an anthropologist, was a woman that was the first Western woman allowed into Tibet in the early 20th century, when it was still a closed off society, right? And she was a Buddhist. She was a Western woman who had converted to Buddhism, but she was an anthropologist. And because she was a Buddhist, they said, all right, fine, you can come in. And then she recounted all these strange magical experiences. She is a scientist, an anthropologist, witnessed. And one of them was this phenomenon of the tulpa, where the village priest taught her this technique where if she visualized something very intensely, she would be able to manifest it. And she used their technique she loved the old Robin Hood stories. Remember, the Robin Hood, there was Friar Tuck, the little jolly guy with a stick, right? So she loved the stories. So she decided to imagine a Friar Tuck figure, in her mind, and using their visualization techniques, the Tibetan bond techniques, she started really visualizing this being, and she started seeing it so brightly that she began to see it really clearly in her mind's eyes. And then one day she started being able to see it with her eyes open, like a hologram.
Wow. Right?
That's like, wow, it worked. And then what starts happening is other people in the village go, who's this fat old dude that sort of appeared, right? So they can start seeing it, right? And then before she could summon it with her own mind, then it just started appearing on its own, doing whatever it wanted to. And it was interacting with the villagers and scaring them, right?
Yeah.
And she couldn't control this thing. And they had to bring in the monks from a nearby monastery who had to do a special ritual to destroy it. This is recounted in her book, Magic and Mystery in Tibet, which is, I think, written in like 1930. This is her personal account of seeing a tulpa with her own eyes, of having created it. So we have this phenomenon where the imagination, you know, we Sufis, I'm a Sufi for those of your viewers who have not heard me before. We are Islamic mystics, but I'm a Sufi. And the Sufis talk very much that the realm of the imagination is more real than the physical world, right? And that it is an actual, it is not imaginary. In fact, the physical world is like Plato's cave. The physical world is the shadow world of the imaginal world. And so, you know, this thing that people have, these global stories of these kinds of creatures, one can dismiss them as folklore, but I'm of a belief that folklore comes from the imaginal world, so it's real.
That's incredibly
helpful. I just had this conversation earlier today.
Smart people have this kind of conversation with people earlier today. That sounds good. I'm in LA. Nobody here talks about imaginal worlds. They're all dumb. But they're good looking, at least. They're good looking. They're dumb looking.
Because it's like, I'm open, but it's like, who's to say, I mean, physical or, you know, a different realm or into the, I mean, who's to really say? So I'm like, it's all real. You know what I mean? Like, there's a part that's realer. But like you said, like anything that you can kind of really put your intention to and manifest, is that not real? I mean, yeah, it is. So,
I mean, you know, this is the challenge of living in our world is that we all, you know, we have both our inner reality, which is personal and subjective, and we have a consensus reality, which everyone else, you know, says is real. And the challenge of us is where's the melding point of that? And especially when your inner reality is very different from the consensus reality, the children go through this, right? Children have their imaginary friends, which are not imaginary. They're talking to a real entity, right? You know, and they have to be later told, there's no imaginary friend. You know, there's no Santa Claus. It's in your head, right? It's not real. And then that's taken away from them because they're drawn away from that personal experience into the consensus reality where they're blinded to it.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I'm curious to know, Cameron, what other instances, aside from the one that you were just talking about, have you heard of, or I don't know?
Well, I've heard of direct experience with a real vampire. Would you like to hear
it? Oh, really? Yes, please.
Yes.
This comes out of the Sufi tradition. So one of my Sufi teachers is a Turkish Sufi, really brilliant guy, right? Part of a very old school traditional Sufi order that goes back to the Ottoman era, and was actually a lot of followers of that tradition were sort of in the Ottoman military. So they have the longer experience with Europe and all those things, right? And so, you know, and he has access to a lot of very ancient sort of knowledge that's kept. This order has a lot of very ancient knowledge that they keep very private, right? And so he was sharing with me that, you know, he once encountered a book that was kept in his order's, you know, Sufi order's archives, an old sort of medieval Turkish book. About how to summon what they call a hortlak. Now, that's the Turkish word for the creature. There's another word, hortdan is one of them, hortlak is one of them. It's hort. It's hort stuff, hort. So, but, you know, like the strigoi is the name in Romania. The actual word vampire seems to come from next door Albania, which is a primarily Muslim country from the Ottoman rule. Albania is vampir, is the name for this creature. That's the word that we've adopted. We've adopted an Albanian word for it, interestingly enough, right? But so the Turks call it the hortlak. And so he found this book. And, you know, he told me about, you know, his sort of young, dumb times when he played around with all kinds of things, right, without realizing consequences. So he found a ritual in the book to summon a hortlak, right? And he did it, and nothing happened. He's like, all right, well, that's just a legend, right? Okay, I guess the book in my hand, put the book away, right? So he tells me a few days later, he has to go meet a friend. You know, the Bosphorus has, you know, in Istanbul has, you know, there's the Asian side and the European side, the two sides of the city. So he's taking a ferry from, I guess, the Asian side to the European side, right? And so he gets on the ferry to go there, and he sees a strange man on the ferry. He said it's largely, there weren't that many people going at the time, and it was just, you know, it was just him and this other guy on this little ferry. And he said he was a very strange looking guy. He said he was, you know, very pale with a totally bald head, right? And there's just something about him that had this very nasty, fearful vibe about him. And he, at the same time, he's like, I was drawn to the guy. I was like, what is it about this guy? This guy's so unique looking and different and a little sinister. So what's it? So he said, I'm drawn to him. And as I approach him, he turns to look at me and he opens his mouth and these massive fangs emerge, right? And his mouth just expands like in a horror movie. It physically like becomes bigger than a human being's mouth could become, right? And hisses at him. And he fell back in just horror, and he realized that's the hortlak. He had summoned it, right? It just appeared when it wanted to.
What was it there for?
Wow.
I mean, it was there. It wasn't there for anything. This guy had summoned it, right? And he's just like, you shouldn't mess. You shouldn't summon this thing, right? And he learned never to do. You know, he had other experiences for other kinds of creatures that he had the misfortune of as a young man conjuring because he didn't know what he was doing, right? But this is a firsthand account given to me by a man I trust, who I've had experiences with that suggests to me that really he has tapped into a higher level of reality, right?
Of course.
And, so he had a personal experience with seeing this inhuman creature. And with his own eyes, and wasn't just, you know, a hologram. It was physically on the boat, right? And he just hid out in the boat for the rest of the trip and took off when the boat landed on the side of the Bosphorus. So that's something that,
wow, you
know, a temporary account directly I heard from someone who I trust.
Yeah.
There are creatures like that in this world.
Yes, wow. There are. And we're going to be talking about those later in a future episode with you.
Yeah, I think I'm coming back again to talk about all kinds of creatures. Yeah.
Yes. And this is exciting.
And getting more people to join my cult and my Patreon.
Yes. We need the link.
Speaking of creatures.
Yes.
Speaking of creatures, Joe has a question and was asking, is there any connection to the North American Wendigo?
It can be. Because, you know, these archetypal things have many names. You know, the Wendigo, the Native Americans will say it's this evil creature that, you know, and there's many stories around it. But what I, you know, there's others. There's a creature in the Philippines called the Aswang, which is very similar to a Wendigo in many ways. And I'll share with you a story of a creature that a friend of mine saw in Indonesia with his own eyes, right? So these kinds of things, what seems to be the unifying element of these kinds of what we would put in the vampire world, you know, because there's different stories, whether they suck blood or the pivotal thing is these entities, what unifies them is their ability to take the life force. Now, in the Eastern European tradition, is actually physically taking the blood as a symbol of that. But, you know, this legend, the story that I recounted of what happened in Romania 15 years ago, people weren't waking up with puncture marks. They were just getting physically sicker. They were losing their life
energy. Force.
Right. And so, you know, there are, I don't want to misquote them, but my understanding is that there are traditional accounts of the Wendigo being able to weaken people and take their energy, right? And all of these things seem to be these dark spirits that can drain the human of energy, and they take different forms. And that seems to be the unique thing. So there is an ancient origin. I don't know if you know the ancient biblical, you know, hidden esoteric Judaism Christianity story of vampires. Do you know it?
Lilith,
yes. So what do you know about Lilith? Well, you'll tell, and then I'll see if I can add anything to it.
Okay, sure.
I'll let her.
So what I know about Lilith is that according to, is it Hebrew tradition?
Yes, it's in the Hebrew tradition. It's not in the Bible itself, but it's in the oral tradition, you know.
Yes, that she was Adam's first wife, that she was created from clay with Adam and refused to be subjugated. And
she literally wouldn't let him sleep with her, have sex with her, with him on top. That was the issue.
Yes.
They had to be side by side. She's like, I'm not going to let you be on top. Yeah.
Right. Because you're not better than me. You're not more powerful than me.
Yeah. And because she had been made of the equal form.
Correct.
Right. You know, she's actually made the same. Eve is later made from Adam as a physical entity coming from Adam. Mm-hmm. She was an actual made of the same clay he was.
Yes. Yep. Yeah. And then she was kind of cast out by God. She was chased down by several angels. And kind of made a deal with the angels. I know I'm skipping over a lot of details here, but she made a deal with the angels and God. And God eventually said, okay, you can go free, but I'm going to kill 100, I think it was 100 of your children every day until you return, something to that effect.
And she was basically having sex with demons and, you know, and the bride of Lucifer kind of stuff, right? And then she was procreating. Yep. So all of that is right. So that's an interesting thing because this is obviously not directly in the Bible, but it is a very ancient part of Jewish mysticism and Jewish oral tradition. And early Christians had this. And in Islamic tradition, I think many Muslims would be surprised to hear that there are stories of Lilith that parallel this, right? Because it's not in the Quran, but there are the same kind of oral tradition. So it's very much a Middle Eastern thing. The thing with Lilith is this. So in ancient Israelite religion, they would have special, you know, amulets and talismans that they would put in. We've now found them archaeologically in houses in Palestine, found them, right? Which is where you have these talismans that seem to have been used specifically to put over cribs to protect babies from Lilith. Because the idea is Lilith despised Adam, and she despised Adam for being this guy who tried to dominate her. And she despised Eve for basically being the woman that gave into it, right? And so she cursed their children. And she said, if you're going to take my children, God's going to kill my children with the devil, then I'm going to kill your children. Yes. And so there was a very common belief that, you know, sudden infant death syndrome, the babies dying in their cribs, was the result of Lilith coming in and essentially taking their life force, right? Mm-hmm. So she became known as the mother of vampires, that, you know, those of her children that were not killed by the angels would then propagate as these kinds of soul-sucking energies, right? And what's interesting about Lilith is this, is that there's two names that pre-exist the Bible that we have found in the Middle East, going back to ancient Assyrian days, Sumerian days. And there's two names. One of them is Michael, the Archangel Michael. The name Michael appears in ancient Sumerian texts as a protector spirit. So this being seems to have been around a long time, right? And Lilitu appears in ancient Sumerian texts as this demon goddess that would take children and take the life force of others. And so this entity pre-exists the Bible as we have it. And has been, you know, it has been there as part of Middle Eastern tradition going back thousands of years, I would suggest, because it is a real entity.
Yes. There's so many stories, so many artifacts that are being discovered. And and I think of one even back to the Dead Sea Scrolls, which was after the ancient Sumerian texts, I want to say.
It's about the first century. I have my own controversial opinion. The official scholarly opinion is the Dead Sea Scrolls are essentially pre-Christianity. I don't believe that. I personally believe that the Qumran community that wrote the Dead Sea Scrolls were early Christians, were actually direct followers of Jesus. I believe that, and I've got my own historical reasons for that. But the official narrative is these are sort of, you know, first century BC texts, which that's the official narrative.
Yeah. That's very interesting, and would actually make a lot of sense if that were the case, and they're now bringing up Lilitu, you know? In those texts, why they would do that. But, you know, not to get completely off topic here, but one of the things that I am fascinated with as far as Genesis and, you know, the whole Lilith and Adam is that it actually talks about man and woman being created at the same time. And later on, though, is when it says that God created man and then created woman from man.
And that is how the rabbis reconcile those two stories, right?
Right, but wouldn't that mean two men?
Part of rabbinic tradition is to try to make all the accounts make sense when they sound contradictory.
Yes, but wouldn't that mean two men, though? Two men as well as two women? That there may have been two men that were created.
I mean, that's not in the early tradition, but, you know, the text, who knows what the text deeply means, right? Yeah. The early tradition that we have was that God made them man and woman, right? And so that's the only text we have. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, Lilith symbolizes a lot of things. You know, she symbolizes the chaotic energy of the cosmos, right? She symbolizes that force that cannot be controlled. You know, it is, and I'll say this to two lovely women, it is the wrath of the woman that's unleashed, right?
Yes.
Okay. You know, heaven hath no fury like a woman scorned, right? That's an archetypal energy. I've experienced that energy. I know it's a real thing. You know, it cannot be reasoned. It's like the Terminator. It cannot be reasoned with. It cannot be bargained with. You know, it will not relent.
I'd agree.
I know that energy.
Very true, though. So Carol has a question, and she asked if you've ever conjured or wanted to conjure.
Well, you know, I'm a Sufi, so I'm involved in all kinds of mystical stuff. But yeah, I mean, I've worked with what things that I think people would call the occult, and, you know, certainly the Sufi masters frown upon people messing with those kinds of things. But, you know, I've worked with Sufi masters that directly work with interdimensional beings. You know, my own Sufi teachers in West Africa, they are directly connected to both angels and what we would call jinn, right? And so as a result, they're able to know what's going on in my life because the jinn, you know, are able to see things in multiple dimensions. And so, you know, I'll go to a party in LA and I'll get a phone call from my sheikh in West Africa calling me that, yeah, the girl you met at the party is not good for you. And look, and how does he know that? Is because the jinn was hanging around with, hey Mac, boss, you know, this guy's hanging out with a girl. And that's how they know it. So yeah, so I've experienced that directly, and yes, so I certainly know certain techniques to do that kind of thing, but it is frowned upon to do it, but nonetheless people do it, so.
Thank you. And Joe says that as a Catholic, he was raised Catholic, he found it very odd that the church fought so long against the Dead Sea Scrolls being published, that it would make sense if it was an early Christian community at Qumran.
There's a reason. I will give my opinion, and this is a controversial opinion, and I don't want to offend anyone who has a religious belief that's different. Okay, this is my opinion. The reason I think the Catholic Church worked very hard to suppress it, especially because I do believe it is the early Jesus Nazarene community, right? Because that's what they were called originally. They were called Nazarenes. I think the Nazarenes were an offshoot of the pre-existing Essene community, and that they essentially took over Qumran, which is a pre-existing Essene settlement. But the problem is this: the texts, if they come from the time of Jesus, it creates a problem because they are clearly real. The two figures that show up in the text from their contemporary discussions of what's happening in their lives are these two figures called the teacher of righteousness and the teacher of the lie. And they are saying that they are essentially claiming to be the followers of the teacher of righteousness, who's the founder of their community, and that their community has been infiltrated by someone who is teaching something that is not true to what the teacher of righteousness taught and is misleading the people. So those who... One interpretation of that, for those who view that, you know, the history of early Christianity a little bit differently than the Catholic Church and the official narrative is that, mm-hmm. you know, for those of us outside the tradition, those could be identified as Jesus, as the teacher of righteousness, and actually Paul, whose ideas are very, very different from the other disciples. We know that from his letters. We know in the letter of Galatians that Paul says that his ideas of Jesus as the Son of God, the risen God who dies for mankind, his ideas are causing him conflict with James, Peter, and John. He names them in the letter to Galatians, and that James, who is Jesus's brother, who is essentially leading the community, possibly at Qumran, right, is leading the community, has sent Peter to check up on him and saying, why are you preaching things that my brother never taught? And Galatians, he says, just ignore them. They knew the Jesus of history. I know the risen Christ. So he's making a claim of essentially being a prophet, that he has direct revelation coming from Christ. And if you are a believer, then Paul's vision of Christianity is directly revealed by Christ, and it's correct. For those of us that are not necessarily part of that tradition, it raises questions as to whether Paul was authorized to ever speak on Jesus's behalf, and his ideas, which were very different from first century Judaism, essentially caused Christianity to become a different religion than Judaism, whether he would have been seen by those followers of that tradition as being the teacher of a lie. They would have seen him that way. So that kind of dichotomy is a real problem for the Catholic Church. And so it's easier to make it go away by saying this is 100 years before Jesus. We don't know who these people were. There's no historical record of who was this teacher of righteousness and teacher of lie. We don't know who they could be. We have no record of that. But it was. But it's less problematic than saying this is Jesus and Paul and they are at odds.
Yes.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Joe agrees that he always thought that Paul was a little different.
It's a different thing. I've actually written a piece on the Huffington Post with an interesting title, Was Jesus a Vegetarian? So if you go search that on Huffington Post, because and I'm not a vegetarian. We Sufis are not. We love our meat, right? But there are Sufis who are vegetarians. And there's actual evidence from the earliest Christian writings that vegetarianism was part of Jesus's message, that he was a vegetarian, and that was actually important to the message. And that we actually find a reference in one of Paul's letters, where he's telling people, stop listening to all those Christians who say you have to eat only vegetables. It's actually there, right? So it's clearly some Christians were saying this, right? And so in that entire article where I talk about that, I go into the difference of the Paul's vision of Christianity fundamentally transforms it from a Jewish movement into a very different movement, which became very successful, right? And if you are a believer, then that's God inspired the right direction. If you're not a believer, you're gay. This guy took this religion and hijacked it, right? It's up to your point of view.
Oh, interesting.
Very interesting.
Let's get back to vampires.
I'm sorry. We're totally getting off the rails.
I got about 20 minutes. I want to get back to as much as I can about the vampires.
Okay. So what is your take on psychic or energetic vampires?
Oh, she took the question from me.
Oh, okay. Well, that's because she's a psychic, right? So you guys are psychically connected, right? She just vampired it out of you, right?
Yep. I just sucked it right out of her.
Yeah, right. We're witnessing the phenomenon in front of us. That is what I suggest all the original vampiric tales are. It's about energy vampirism, right? Yeah. And it's about draining of the soul, right? And so with that comes psychic thing. And we've all felt that. We all have that friend who we feel weaker around. We all have that friend.
Psychic vampire.
Right? We all have that character in our lives, right? Who you're in a perfectly good mood. They come into your life and suddenly you're like left like this at the end, right? You know, it's just like they pull your energy out and, you know, with their drama and their nonsense and whatever. And they don't ever seem to be affected by it. You're the one that's affected, right? So that's a real human phenomenon. And that's a very human understanding of this. But, you know, I would suggest there are also entities that do this on a much deeper, more dangerous level.
And how important it is to try to kind of block your energy off from those types of people once you recognize that. And
it's harder when they're like family members. I know people who's like, whose sister is that person, whose brother is that person. I was like, oh, what do you do? You're sort of stuck, right? But you gotta build up your barriers.
Yeah, for sure.
Now, I know Joe said that in Connecticut, here in Connecticut, where I'm from, they thought they found some vampires. And I just remembered when speaking to someone earlier today, I do remember that story because I think it was on like the Traveler Discovery Channel where they thought that they found vampires in Connecticut. I don't remember all the details, but what is your belief
these
about,
are sort of modern contemporary people like Salem's Lot, like people that they thought were modern contemporary vampires? What were they thinking?
Joe could probably, if he can put the comments down a little more about, because he was part of that. So he can speak a little bit more to that. But obviously, there were a lot of traditions where they thought people were coming back from the dead. And so there's
it was during the time of consumption. So,
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's tuberculosis, right? Mm-hmm. Consumption mm-hmm. is tuberculosis. Right?
Yeah, tuberculosis. So, yeah.
Well, I mean that's as we're going through sort of a global event like that. You know, a lot of let's just say that there's a lot of medical stuff going on, there's a lot of fear and a lot of stuff that's misunderstood. I'm not denying, like I said, I believe in vampires. I believe in all kinds of things, right? Mm-hmm. I just don't know that these things are properly understood, especially when there's moments of mass fear. You know, there was a famous, you know, we think of the Bram Stoker's Dracula is actually came at the end of a long period of vampire novels in the 19th century, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, there's actually a great one that's sort of the lesbian vampire novel, which I was like, oh, that sounds good, right? But it's about a female vampire, essentially lesbian, Carmilla. So you know, all the Victorians could release all their issues, you know, they could have lesbian porn in the form of a vampire novel, right? And so it's great. Porn always finds a way. You know, it's like they said in Jurassic Park, life finds a way, porn finds a way, right?
That's true.
Just the way they're essentially connected, right? And so, but yes, but it came. Why was vampire so were so much part of the literature of 19th century England is because there had been a medical pandemic of some kind in the early 19th century and 1800s and. Then you suddenly had all these stories. There was what was called a vampire mass hysteria, where people started digging up graves, and they believed that you know that the illness that was spreading was a result of this. Maybe it was, maybe it wasn't. But nonetheless, these medical events tend to launch these moments. That's what happened, like that village. People were getting sick, right? They assumed it was because of this man.
Yeah, and especially during a time.
Exactly.
I'm going to go back to the video that Joe shared with us earlier that. Somebody was talking about the man who was being interviewed was talking about how at the time when consumption and tuberculosis was running rampant, that these people were literally wasting away and they noticed that the dead bodies were bloating and swelling. So they had to logically conclude that clearly we're wasting away alive. These dead people must be just consuming all that energy.
And there's the argument that many of these are from lack of understanding of decomposition. I'm not so sure I believe that because I think human beings have sort of at least known the process of decomposition since ancient times. You know, that's why we bury them. We sort of understand that. We see that with our animals, right? You know, if you're a farmer and your animal dies and you find your cow dead in the field after a couple of days, you'll see that. So I'm not sure I believe that because I think that's projecting backwards onto people a stupidity that isn't real, that, you know, they knew more about nature than we do because, you know, they saw it with their own eyes and they lived in it. So, you know, I think there are often hysterias, as I think much of the planet currently is prone to hysteria. Part of the human condition. It's an unfortunate side of us when, you know, there's something aspect of us that makes us spread fear like a virus to each other and shuts down our ability to reason. So you have to have both sides of the brain. Like I very much live in the right side of the brain, which is the creative side. I live there, but obviously I'm a former lawyer, so I know how to balance that. And most people, they switch on one or the other and, you know, you need both. And if you just switch on the rational side, then you have an empty world without magic and meaning and an inaccurate understanding of the world. And if you just switch on the left side, I'm sorry, which is the rational side, switch on the right side, then every personal fantasy and delusion becomes real. and then you can spread it to other people and everyone's delusional together. So you got to have both. Mm-hmm. Balance, right?
I agree. We're definitely going through that right now in the world. But it always comes around.
What's fascinating to me is that the contempt that we in modern civilization have had when we look at a history at the Salem witch trials, you know, at all at the McCarthy era and all that stuff, and the, you know, the mass hysterias that have happened, you know, mass hysteria is every 20 years. It's human nature, right? And so, right after September 11th, right, which was a real event, and then you suddenly had mass hysteria, Muslims and immigrants, and, you know, we all gave up. We all thought not bringing a bottle of shampoo in our luggage was somehow going to prevent terrorism, right? You know, political power people go, oh, here we go, sucker time. Let's start using these suckers, right? It's human nature.
Gotcha. What is your thought on people who claim that they are vampires and actually, you know, drink blood? Like, what is your take?
I think they're LARPing, you know, they're live action role playing. I think a lot of modern culture is live action role playing, right? Everyone is identifying with this thing. And, you know, the healthy part that it comes from is that childlike desire to, you know, live with the imaginary friend and to bring the imaginal world into reality. That's a very good thing. The problem, again, then eventually you start living in a consensus world. There is a reason for a consensus world, you know, and eventually you're off in your own planet drinking blood and part of your subculture and whatever, doing your thing. And okay, it's cool. But we're sort of at a weird moment right now where society feels the need to take everyone who's LARPing and make them the norm. And like everyone else is like, can I just be normal? No, everyone's got to LARP.
What happened to doing these things in the privacy of your own bedroom and your own bathroom?
why do we have to change language? Why do we have to change culture to reflect LARPing? You know, and that's not not sustainable. You know, it's just, again, we're pendulum is swinging one way towards crazy, then it'll swing another way towards jerk, and then swing back to crazy. It's just this way.
some of these people who are drinking blood, they're actually saying that drinking the blood gives them more energy. I don't know, you know, I'm not a specialist or an expert on that, but I was watching a show where
I don't know the truth of that. From a spiritual energetic way, you know, there's ancient my Sufi masters on West Africa, you know, and voodoo, Vodun, comes from West Africa. And so when I've been there, I've been to Senegal. They've told me, you know, avoid certain spiritual practitioners who claim to be Sufis, but they're doing essentially necromancy. They're going to graves. And that's all that old dark voodoo tradition came from West Africa. So the original version of it's still there and still practiced. And blood is heavily important part of it. And so there are spiritual energies to it that work. My experience with voodoo is that it is an incredibly effective occult tradition. I mean, if you want magic that works, voodoo is that, right? I mean, it can actually make things happen. There's a lot of ceremonial magicians who spend all their time doing this pentagram in the air, whatever, but they, you know, they can't pay their rent, right? They don't have their right? But I'm at this high level of, you know, of Golden Dawn initiation, but their life is a joke. Whereas in my experience of voodoo is you do this thing with the Loa spirit, it's going to give you what you want. And then you have to pay it, right? Mm-hmm. It's real. I mean, I've experienced it. Voodoo works, right? And you don't know what you're doing. Mm-hmm. So the dark there, and you know, within voodoo, there's the right-hand path and the left-hand path, and the left-hand path has this darker side, which utilizes blood. And so there's people, they're doing their thing. You know, I try not to judge people until it becomes a problem. Like, you know, if you want to give up your blood to this person, fine. If you're giving up your blood to the point that you're actually becoming unhealthy yourself, I think maybe an intervention is needed, right? That maybe this isn't the most healthy subculture for you.
That was one thing. Symbiotic relationships of people who claim to be sanguine vampires and donors who are willing to give them blood.
Yeah, it's like a form of BDSM.
Yeah.
That's all.
The person that I saw, they had permission.
No. I told you, porn and life.
Basically.
Why do we have Neanderthal art carvings of chicks with big breasts? I'm going, it is what it is, okay? This is primordial.
Yep.
Porn and life, they find a way.
So before we end, though, because we know that you have to get going soon.
I do have another thing I have to get to, yes.
Yes, please fill us in on your Patreon and what's going on with you lately, where people can find you, how we can support you.
Well, I used to be on Twitter, but I was kicked off of Twitter because again, I guess I wasn't politically, you know, who knows? I guess I wasn't politically, everything I said was then later affirmed to be true by other people, but I wasn't the person allowed to say it. So I was kicked off, whatever. Forget Twitter. So I still have
an Instagram.
I still have an Instagram, which is, you know, my name, Cameron Pasha 72. If anyone wants to follow me on Instagram, I don't post a lot on there. Unlike most of my friends in Los Angeles, I don't feel the need to show pictures of myself all day long. But, you know, I do put, I actually been posting sort of thoughts and philosophical comments on Instagram more than pictures. But some of my adventures in Bulgaria are up there if you want to see them. The thing that's actually most important in my life right now is I started a Patreon just about a month ago, and it's become incredibly successful. We have almost 100 subscribers within just 3 or 4 weeks, right? And and I put out, you know, I'm in Hollywood, so I put out my commentary on Hollywood and about a lot of behind the scenes things that are happening. I've given a lot of predictions about things that are going to happen that have happened. Literally, you know, I made a prediction about 3 weeks ago on my Patreon, and it happened and became a big deal in the YouTube world, where people were like, my God, Cameron Pasha said this was going to happen with Disney, and things happened exactly as it predicted, right? Because I've been 20 years in the industry. So talking about that, I haven't done a lot yet of mystical stuff, but if people want to join, first of all, I hope you'll join anyway, but if people want mystical themed articles, I'm happy to post them on Patreon. I try to post something every few days. So my Patreon is patreon.com/my name, Cameron Pasha. I'll put it, I don't know, we put it on a link or whatever. How do we do that?
We'll get it for you.
We'll put it in there. Yeah, but so yeah, but it's been very helpful to me because it gives me a chance to become financially independent of this crazy Hollywood system that I'm in. And I can then have direct interaction with people and able to give them, like my third novel, which is based on the biblical story of Esther. My first two novels were published by Simon Schuster. Wow. I published my third novel. And before we've even put it out to be published, I've decided to publish it chapter by chapter on my Patreon. So people are reading my third novel directly on Patreon.
So,
it's fun. We're creating a fun community. I do Q&As and try to be as interactive as possible. And I do, like, just while we were talking, someone just emailed me for a screenwriting consulting, like people who have books or screenplays, I do consulting for them. And someone on Patreon just emailed me. I'm arranging that session with them. So yeah, so that's what I'm doing. It actually helps. The economics of the world we're in is changing, and the work that you lovely ladies are doing is going to be monetized in a new way for everyone, and that's good. That's going to break the control of information that sort of very dark forces have had over us for the past century. And I mean, we're on a podcast that talks about spirituality. A lot of media itself, I mean, maybe that's a topic for another conversation, but my own experiences with the occult in Hollywood, it's very real. It's at a very high level. You know, they let you believe this is all nonsense while they're all going to Eyes Wide Shut parties and doing all kinds of things and darker things, right?
Well, that was real. I knew that was real.
Eyes Wide Shut. I actually, if I can share, because I'll share with you on this channel, yeah. I got an email, a friend of mine who is a practicing Wiccan. He's a very high level Wiccan, witch who's been initiated at a very high level. And he contacted me because he had placed a protection spell around me because I got a lot of enemies in Hollywood. And he contacted me saying, I need to talk to you about something. So, he had placed these special stones when he does a spell, and then he came, one day saw the stone's colors had changed, meaning someone had tried to act. The spell had been activated. Someone had made an attack that the spell protected against. And he said he got contacted by people through Twitter, who essentially created a fake account. We need to talk to you, and he's like, so he essentially, and they gave him very occult, you know, symbols from his own tradition to essentially do a talk under truce. And so they did. So he had this phone call with these people who had just contacted him saying, so we understand you placed a protection ritual around this Cameron Pasha guy. And he's like, yeah. He's like, well, you know, one of our guys was hired to cause him problems, right? That's topic for another conversation, but I have reached that level where they all know who I am. And so he's like, and then that their guy that they hired, the occultist they hired to create problems for me, got hit by a bus.
No way.
They figured out, okay, there was some kind of protection energy around this guy that we were targeting. So we want to know what's going on. And so this he shared with me. He said, I don't want to reveal their names or the people that sent them. He said, you will know who they are when they send them. But, you know, I know for a fact this kind of stuff is real in Hollywood. My Hollywood friends don't know it. Like my dumb screenwriter friends, they're like, that's all nonsense. I'm like, I've actually encountered occultists in Hollywood. They haven't, so they don't know what's happening, right? And so they're like, he actually made a truce. And he said, leave Cameron alone. You know, next time you try it, it'll actually, it will be worse than a bus accident. So just leave him alone. And he called me back. If someone had a relationship with, I know he's not lying to me or making up a fanciful tale. Right. Because I've also had my Sufi masters say exactly the same thing. When I went to Bulgaria, I met a Sufi. He said, yeah, you need to be careful. There's someone, you know, these people in Hollywood are doing this specific kind of occulting on you. And this was then affirmed independently by my Wiccan friend who had no idea I had that conversation. He said exactly the same thing as the Bulgarian Sufi had. So there's a dark side of Hollywood that is accessing.
I believe that.
And we can talk about it another time, but I think it would be interesting to people. And literally part of the reason they said they came at me is I'd said on some live streams about the Eyes Wide Shut parties, and the guys involved in the Eyes Wide Shut party says, I shouldn't be talking about that. He's not supposed to be talking about that. You know, remember Stanley Kubrick died before the movie came out.
Yeah.
You know, he's not supposed to be doing this, right? And they're like, okay, this guy's talking about this stuff. I'm like, yeah, no, you know. You guys ever invite me to these parties? I never get invited. You know, you see these guys don't. These cults are safe. Just send me some hot chicks. Sure, I'll go along with the sex occult party. No, they have to send me evil magicians trying to mess me up. Just invite me to the party. I'll go along. It never occurs to them. That never occurs.
Well, it's going to occur to a lot of people now. Now that we've put your future cult.
I guess I'm trying to create this cult, but God keeps protecting me from my sex cult.
It's like, probably your mom.
I'm like, why is it not for me? Why is it not for me?
It's probably your mom. Your mom's in her
bedroom.
My mom's
like, this is not right. I'm like, whatever.
Two things before you go. Yeah. Terry says that you are amazing.
Thank you.
And you're just a great wealth of knowledge, which we all knew. That's why we wanted you to be here. But I actually had some ideas that I was going to spring on you a little later. Yeah. And you actually just confirmed for me just now what you're talking about. Some of the things you just said I had ideas about. So we will talk behind the scenes another day.
Yeah.
But we would obviously love to have you back.
No, I love coming on, you ladies. You have great energy. You have to do another one of your post-reaction videos. Your post-reaction video was great for the last one, right? You got another post-reaction video.
We definitely will.
Well, I'm typing in your thing here. I'm going to type my little Patreon right here, and then you guys let people know because there we go. And you know, if I get enough Patreon members, maybe we can do the cult occult sex party Patreon separately.
Yes. So let's all. I'm joining right now.
Let's do the fun Eyes Wide Shut. Let's do the fun Eyes Wide Shut. Human sacrifice. Everyone walks away having had a good time. Yeah,
I like that idea very much.
Energy from it.
I'm buying my mask.
Sounds good.
Thank you so much all for right, being here with
you
us.
Thank you so like, much. We're doing
this again in a few weeks, right? So we're doing one more thing at the end of the month.
Yep.
Yes.
7th.
All right. God bless you.
All right. Bye.
Good night.